Are you an accredited investor looking for a new opportunity to generate passive income and build the retirement of your dreams? Then elevate your investment game with Viking Capital, where wealth meets wisdom. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just starting out, Viking Capital can help guide you towards financial freedom through passive real estate investing. With strong and transparent underwriting, Viking identifies low-risk opportunities with the goal of preserving investor capital and maximizing long-term growth potential. And their accessible and responsive investor relations team will help you understand how each investment will impact your unique financial goals. With $800 million in assets acquired, more than $230 million in equity raised, and more than 5,000 units under management, Viking Capital is your path to early retirement. To learn about Viking Capital's latest investment opportunity, which is available for you right now, visit vikingcapitalinvestments.com/best ever. That's vikingcapitalinvestments.com/best ever to get started today.
And when we refinanced the property 9 months later into our typical 10-year fixed rate loan, it appraised for $2 million above our purchase price.
Are you ready for the best real estate investing advice ever? Join Joe Fairless and today's best ever guests as they share it with you. It's the best ever advice with none of the fluff. Let's go.
Heard of crowdfunding and still curious about how you can benefit from it? Well, we've got a step-by-step guide put together just for you by the best ever team and Patch of Land, the industry's leading crowdfunding experts. The best crowdfunding crash course ever, episodes 152, 159, 166, and 173 will provide you all you need to know to get started and begin benefiting immediately. Whether it's getting access to funds for your project or passively investing in other people's deals, the time is now to get started with Patch of Land. Go to patchofland.com/best ever to grab your copy of the top 10 answers to the top 10 crowdfunding questions. That's patchofland.com/best ever. Hello, best ever listeners. Welcome to the best real estate investing advice ever show. I'm Joe Fairless, and I'm with our guest today, Sean Sweeney. Hi, Sean.
Hey, Joe. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you for being on the show. And Sean is joining us from Minneapolis, Minnesota. He is extremely focused in the multifamily space. And let me tell you a little bit about his experience. You're going to be impressed. He's been a real estate professional for over 11 years, and he's been focused on multifamily during those 11 years. He has a company called Timberland Partners. It's a two-person team. And if I were to stop right now and I were to ask you, with a two-person team, multifamily, how many multifamily units do you think they've been able to acquire? What would you say? Well, whatever your answer is, probably at least double it. They've been able to acquire over 4,000 multifamily units with a combined value of over $250 million. And non-real estate related, one of the most interesting facts we've had on the show, and you're probably like in the high 200s episode, Sean, is that he was on the movie What Women Want, the movie with Mel Gibson, and he's actually had dinner with Mel Gibson. So he is a man of many talents. With that being said, Sean, can you give the best ever listeners a little bit more about your background and what you're focused on now?
Sure, I'd love to, Joe, and hi, best ever listeners. Really happy to be here with you guys today, and certainly grateful, Joe, for the opportunity to chat with you. Before I dive in, let me take one step back and just qualify my two-person team. We've got a huge team here. Our acquisitions team is two people. So it is technically just two of us putting the deals together, but we do have a pretty big infrastructure behind us that helps support that. So I can't take full credit for all the 4,000 units. We've got a good team behind us as well.
Just take half credit, not full.
Yeah, well, then here, I'll take credit for 2,000. That's right. Well, yeah, I can tell you a little bit about my background. So as you mentioned, Joe, I was I had a couple of years in the acting world. It was I like to say a really fun experience, but not a very lucrative time. I spent about 3 years auditioning, taking classes, doing other things, trying to make it in the the world as an actor, and didn't go as well as I had hoped, but had some fun stories. I got out of acting, actually. Maybe you've heard of Jeremy Piven. He's one of the lead characters in the movie Entourage, and was certainly on the show for a long time. His dad, Burn Piven, was one of my acting teachers in Chicago, and I worked for about 2 years to get into a class with him. You had to audition, and I kept not getting accepted, but eventually I did. And about 3 weeks in, I was so excited to be in this class. Byrne took me aside after class, and he said, "You know, Sean, you strike me as somebody that's too normal to be an actor." And I said, "I'm not sure if this is a compliment or you're making fun of me or what exactly is going on here." And he looked at me and he said, "Listen, if there's anything else in the whole world that you can do and be happy, go do it." He said, "This is a really tough road that you've chosen." And his son at this time was not famous at all. I mean, had been a sidekick to John Cusack in a couple of movies. And he used Jeremy as an example. And he said, "Listen, my son is a fantastic actor. He's in his early 30s. He's been doing this for 20 years. And he still sleeps on his friends' couches. You know, if you're happy to be 50 years old and be sleeping on couches waiting for your big break, then let's do this and I'll help you. I'll help you get there. But if there's anything else you can do and be happy, please go do that." I took that advice and went home and kind of was like, I'm not sure what to make of that exactly. In a sad twist, he actually passed away about 2 weeks after he told me that, which was tough. And he had cancer and not told most of us. So I took that as a sign that it was time to find something else to do. And funny enough, 2 years later, when his son, when Entourage became a big hit, his son Jeremy, you know, won an Emmy for his role and got up on stage and gave his speech and, you know, was thanking everyone and took a moment and said, "You know, I need to thank my dad. My dad used to take people aside and say, hey, this is a really tough road. If there's anything you want to ever go do, please go do it." And Jeremy, he took his Emmy and he stuck it up in the air and he looked to the sky and he said, "Dad, all I ever wanted to do was be an actor." I happened to be watching it and got goosebumps and was like, "Wow, I can't believe that happened." And he told me that.
Wow.
Which was pretty crazy. But so I took that, thought about going to law school, like a lot of liberal arts majors, thought about going to law school, had the pleasure to work in a law firm for about a year after my acting career. Didn't like it at all. Just thought it was not the right place for me. Ended up moving to California. My girlfriend and I at the time, who's now my wife, were living in Chicago. We moved out to California so she could go to graduate school. And I had to kind of figure out what I wanted to do. Got a nice sales job at a money management firm, but quickly realized I wasn't really into that. And was talking to as many people as I can, trying to figure out, you know, what other options are out there? What other kinds of things are out there? Hadn't had a business school, hadn't had a business degree, didn't really know kind of what to do. I had an uncle who was actually developing some really cool properties at the time, and he was one of the people I talked to. And the longer I talked to him, the more I thought, wow, this is really interesting and really exciting. And I like design, and I thought I'd be good at kind of managing teams and putting people together, and thought, hey, I'm going to be a real estate developer. I was probably 25 at this time. So I set out to do that, sent out resumes, looked for a job for a long time, and as you can probably imagine, didn't have much luck. Apparently, real estate developers don't want to take a chance on a former actor as a project manager who has no experience and no real estate knowledge. What I quickly figured out is, hey, I've probably got to go to grad school. I've got to have a little bit more credibility behind me while I'm looking for this job. But in the meantime, I kept sending out resumes, looking for opportunities. And one day I got a phone call from this really nice woman. And she said, "Hey, I got your resume, but you look like you have a sales background and we're looking for a receptionist." And I said, "Well, you know, I'm interested, because, Joe, my plan was, hey, if somebody will talk to me, I'll go talk to them and maybe I can get a lead out of the situation, right? Maybe they'll help point me in the right direction or give me some good advice or something." So this woman said, "Hey, you know, we'd be interested in meeting with you if you were interested." And I said, "Great, let's do it." Turns out their office was about an hour away from my apartment at the time. So I drove up there, met with them, had a great feeling about the people I met. And long story short, about 2 weeks later, they offered me the job to be the receptionist. Everybody I told about that told me I was crazy and that probably wasn't a very good idea. I was going to take about a 50% pay cut and drive an hour away each day, commute an hour a day. But I had this really good feeling about these guys, and they made me a deal and said, "Listen, if you can come in here, show us you're a hustler, show us you care about real estate, you know, at some point, we'll give you more to do." And
they told me that was going to be a year or two. So I decided, okay, let's do it. Luckily enough, they got busy quickly. And, you know, 2-3 months in, they said, hey, do you know how to do Excel? I said, sure. I didn't, but I went home at night and figured out how to do it. Took a couple night classes at Berkeley and got up to speed on real estate as quickly as I could. And within 1 year at that firm, I was actually made a project manager, managing large apartment communities and condo developments up and down Silicon Valley. So I was with that firm for about 5 or 6 years, ran you know, major condo developments and apartment developments in the San Francisco area up until 2009. And then in 2009, when the economy slowed, my wife, who's from Minneapolis, and I grew up in Madison, Wisconsin, had always thought about moving back to the Midwest. Things had been going well at that firm, so it didn't feel like a good move. But when the market slowed, I thought, hey, this would be a time to take that chance. So I was fortunate, found a job as an asset manager here for a large multifamily developer, helping them. I spent a couple years helping them clean up a portfolio of troubled assets. I was flying all over the country, reassuring lenders, residents, tenants, mayors, anybody that was had a vested interest in the property that we were on it and we would get it fixed. Then in late, I was also networking a lot, being new to Minneapolis. And in late 2011, as the market began improving, this opportunity at Timberland Partners presented itself to me. The company had a little over 5,000 units at the time and was looking to grow and wanted somebody to help in that growth. And I was really fortunate that I was given the opportunity, and we haven't really looked back. I've spent the last 4 years scouring the country for apartment deals. And as you mentioned earlier, we've taken the company from a little over 5,000 units to a little over 9,300 right now.
So many things to talk about. I'm going to start with your approach to just your business approach. When you throw yourself into situations and then you figure out how to react after you put yourself in that situation, you know, there's a lot of examples here. When you were at the job that you had, but you were applying and you ended up getting the receptionist job, what's that like from a psychological standpoint to have the 50% pay cut and to do different type of responsibilities? Not one's not better than the other, it's just different type of responsibilities.
Sure.
Than you were used to doing.
Well, the first word I would use is humbling. It was amazing. I mean, I literally sat at the front desk and was the receptionist. And people would come in, the guys I worked for made a point to introduce me to everybody as the receptionist. I mean, they really put me through the ringer. We'd have, you know, bankers and other folks come in, and some, frankly, Joe, weren't much older than I was. And they would say, hey, this is Sean. He's our receptionist. Can he get you a cup of coffee? Can he make you some copies? What would you like him to do for you? They really tested me. And it was as I said, very humbling. But, you know, any ego or any sense of me being better than others or having any sort of feelings like that quickly erased them. And I think it really taught me that, you know, you got to dig deep and start from the bottom and work hard. And it doesn't really matter what people say to you in the meantime.
What have you learned from the variety of experiences that you've had, and how have you applied that to your business now? You know, you've been at a law firm, sales job at a money management company. You've been an actor with Mel Gibson. You've been a receptionist. Oh, my God, you can't make that up.
It sounds funny just hearing all that. Yeah, it sounds bizarre. I can't really believe that's me.
It sounds bizarre. It sounds bizarre. Yes, it does. If there was a theme song to this episode, it'd be that how bizarre, how bizarre. What have you taken away from those experiences that you've applied to what you're doing now in acquiring multifamily?
Sure. Well, it you know, I think one of the things that you touched on already, Joe, is that it really taught me that I can jump into things and figure them out as I go. And as you know, being a real estate investor yourself, that's a lot of what real estate investing is, you know, looking at something, trying to figure something out and never knowing how it's going to turn out or what's going to happen the next day, the next week, or the next month. I know you've mentioned you're involved in a development project, so I'm sure you're seeing that firsthand, that what you probably planned out a year or two ago is happening to some degree, but I bet there's been a lot of twists and turns in the road as you've been going. So I think that's certainly something that I've learned, that it's never going to be a straight line. It's never going to be exactly how you plan it out. And what you want to do is have the best team around you possible and try to do your best to figure it out as you go. So I think that's certainly one thing. I think being in those, you know, those various industries, as you said, has also taught me that you know, successful people and people in general are not really that different. Everybody kind of wants the same things. And I think people want people, they want to do business and they want to deal with people they like and people that are nice and things of that nature as well. So I think it's really taught me how to be good about interacting and getting to know a large variety of different types of people.
Now I want to switch gears to acquisitions and multifamily, your bread and butter. When you're looking at a property and you have to make a judgment call on it in 5 minutes, how do you quickly, just back of the napkin, how does your brain work when you run the numbers? What are the questions you ask yourself and what are you looking for?
I think to start with, Joe, the quick answer is, you know, at Timberland Partners here, we have kind of a target that we're looking for. We're primarily long-term holders. So we're looking for buildings, apartment communities built typically in the 1980s and 1990s, usually Class B suburban type properties, 150 units or greater, located in what we consider A and B locations. And we think that each property we look at or want to acquire needs to have some value add component that could be physically adding value to the property or on the management side, adding value. So the first step in my process is just to kind of think about it from that point of view. Does it fit most of those boxes, if you will, right away? Then I quickly dig a little bit deeper into each one and think, okay, look, I look at the location. How do I feel about that? And probably most important, Joe, is what's the story behind this property? Who owns it? Why are they selling it? What's their motivation? And is there some opportunity for the next buyer to add some value to that property, as I said, in one way or another? My next move is to quickly, if it kind of meets all those things, call the broker, call whoever's in charge, have a quick conversation with them. Try to get a sense of where they think it's going to shake out pricing-wise, how many people are looking at it, how competitive it's going to be and all that. And then what I'll quickly do, Joe, is look at the income statement or any information I have about the numbers, and I'll do a very, very quick back-of-the-envelope analysis where I'll look at the income. I'll use, you know, let's say 50% for expenses. I'll come up with an NOI. I'll then, you know, divide that by the cap rate and I'll see what the price looks like for me on a price per unit and an overall price. And if that feels like it's in the range of kind of what they were thinking and what we're thinking, then I'll dive in and spend more time. But that's kind of my process because we'll see, you know, in a good week, I'll have 20, 30 deals cross my desk and I don't have time to, you know, spend 5 hours underwriting each one. I have to quickly kind of weed through which ones I want to spend more time on and which ones I don't. So that's kind of my quick and dirty process to at least get to the next step a lot of times.
When you do the 50% expenses, is that 50% of the effective gross income or is that 50% of the potential?
I usually do 50% of the effective gross income.
So you're factoring in the vacancies and the other income and all that already?
Exactly. I'm taking all that into account quickly and then doing 50% of that. And, you know, as you know, Joe, it on a nicer, you know, newer built property, those expenses might be closer to 42 to 43%. And on an older, you know, 60s or 70s built deal, those could be higher, 55 to 60. So I'll take that into account as well. But a lot of, as I said before, a lot of what we look at is 80s and 90s built stuff. So of our portfolio, that's about 9,300 units, our expenses range from about 48% on the low end to about 52 on the high end. So at least for me, it's a pretty good rule of thumb that I can use. It as you say, you know, as we go further into the process, we will obviously dive into each one of those line items with a fine-tooth comb and really dig in and see what the actual numbers are. But that's just a quick and easy way at the beginning to know if it's something I should spend more time on or not.
And do you have a certain spreadsheet that you use to do those numbers quickly versus, you know, the one that is the 5, 7, 10, you know, whatever pro forma?
When I do the quick back of the envelope, a lot of times I'll literally do it on the back of a piece of paper. When we dig in a little more, I do have like a one-page sheet where what I can do is quickly put in whatever trailing numbers I have from the seller and then make up a year one pro forma myself and kind of see what I think will happen will relates to what's currently happening. Then if we move past that point, we have a massive spreadsheet that has, you know, 20 tabs on it that we use to analyze all aspects of the property.
That one page sheet, is that something that is proprietary to your group, or could you share that with the best ever listeners?
No, I can definitely share that. I mean, it's literally an Excel sheet that I put together that has three or four different columns on it, a couple of formulas, and that's it. So I'd be happy to share that.
Awesome. Yeah, if you can email that to me, and then best ever listeners, I'll include that in the show notes of this episode so that you just go to the show notes page on my website, and then you can download it yourself and grab it.
Sure.
All right. You have such an interesting background, and I love talking multifamily too, because that's what I'm focused on. So I'm really enjoying our conversation, Sean.
Good. Me too. Thanks, Joe.
Well, here we go. Here's the kind of the kicker for this show. Sean, what is your best real estate investing advice ever?
So I've been extremely fortunate, as we've kind of talked. I've had a lot of different experiences. And in my time in real estate, I have been so fortunate that I've been able to learn this craft from people I consider some of the masters of the industry. I've learned a lot from a lot of different people. So the best real estate investing advice I've ever received is be easy to do business with and make your brokers look good.
How do you deliver on be easy and make them look good?
So there's a few different ways to do it. I mean, and if you think about it kind of from a big picture, who do brokers and sell? You know, anytime you get into a multifamily deal, you're going to spend the next 2 to 3 months interacting a lot with a certain broker and a certain seller. So I try to think about it from their point of view and think, if I'm the broker, if I'm the seller, who's the kind of person I want to spend the next 2 or 3 months talking to? You know, is it the guy that yells at them every time something goes wrong? Or, hey, is it the guy that's really nice to work with, doesn't get upset, you know, does what he says he's going to do and sticks to his word? I think there's a couple ways to go about doing that. The owner of our company now is a former broker. He spent about 20 years as an apartment broker. So he always stresses to me and my partner, be easy to do business with. And what that means is, you know, do as much work on a property before you put a letter of intent together and before you sign a purchase agreement. So you're not the group that goes around tying up properties and then figuring out if you want to buy them or not. Certainly, you know, there's due diligence you need to do, and there's unit walks and reviewing leases, and there can always be stuff that comes up that you weren't expecting or you didn't know about. But if we're buying a $20 million apartment community, we're going to do as much work as we can before we put our initial offer in. And then if we get the property and we're working through due diligence, we're not going to retrade. If we see if there's a $5,000 hiccup that comes up that we didn't know about, you know, if you want to be easy to do business with and get repeat business from sellers and brokers, the smartest thing to do is to eat that $5,000 yourself and continue on in the process.
What are some other ways that you and your team are easy to work with and make brokers look good?
I think the main thing is to do what stick to your word. Make an offer that you feel good about and then make it happen. Be very responsive, be very respectful. Anytime you're speaking to the broker or the seller, remember that you're trying to create a win-win-win situation. You know, I use a personal example. I've been trying to buy properties in Nashville since 2012. It's a very competitive market down there. There's some fantastic growth and long-term demographics that are really working in favor of Nashville right now. And what I started doing in 2012 was I made it my mission to become friends with the top apartment brokers in that market. And the way I did that was by underwriting and touring just about every deal that they had listed. Even if it was something I knew that I wasn't going to necessarily want to buy, but I wanted those brokers to know that we were credible, serious buyers. And after I tour the deal and run numbers, I always spent the time, again, even if I wasn't going to buy the property, talking them through how I personally analyzed it. You know, that allowed the brokers to kind of understand, okay, this is how this guy thinks about deals. And then I think, you know, I did that for a couple of years and it works out, because last fall I got a call from one of those brokers who let me know there was a deal about to come out that he thought would be a great fit for us, kind of based on what he knew. We jumped on it right away. And so by the time it came time to make an offer, we knew the deal inside and out, and we had to get aggressive. You have to get aggressive in today's market to win deals. You sometimes have to stretch your number a little further than you're comfortable with. And you have to feel really good about a deal if you're going to do that. And we had done the work up front. And we ultimately won the deal. And we won the deal because the brokers knew us. They could vouch for us. They knew we were credible. And so this broker had no reservations about recommending us to the seller. We worked through some very difficult issues during due diligence. We were able to, as I said, communicate with them, be very open and honest about the challenges we were facing. And we ultimately closed the deal ahead of schedule. And it's funny, it doesn't happen all the time, but we did such a good job on this one that the seller actually called us afterward, said we were great to work with, and that he'd be happy to be a reference for us in the future. So we bought a great deal. The broker had a good experience, made money, looked really good, and the seller felt like he sold his property, made money, and had a good experience. I mean, that was a win-win-win that was a really great experience to be part of, and that's what we shoot for. And you know, funny enough, the same thing just happened recently with the other broker in Nashville. I've been getting to know. We'll be closing our second deal there next month.
What are some, you mentioned really quickly, and then we'll go into the lightning round. You mentioned difficult issues during due diligence, and you also mentioned stretch your numbers a little more than you're comfortable with. Follow-up question for each. One, what were the difficult issues? And then two, how much can you stretch your numbers before it becomes too much stretching?
Okay, well, those are both very good questions, Joe. I'll take them in order here. As far as things that came up during due diligence, on the deal in Nashville, it had a HUD certification as part of the deal. It had nothing to do with the rents or the income limits or anything like that. But when the property was built in the early 1980s, there was a HUD requirement that it remain an apartment community for 50 years. So what we had to do was get in touch with HUD and just simply get that certification transferred from the seller to our company. It was basically a formality that we thought would take, you know, a few days. It ended up taking us about a month and a half of working nonstop just to simply get that piece of paper transferred. The seller had to do a bunch of work. We had to do a bunch of work, and the poor broker had to do a number of things that they typically don't. And, you know, it was just a big challenge that we had to get through together. And I think by being open and honest, and, you know, when I had an issue with it or there was a problem, I would call them and say, listen, guys, here's what's happening. Here's my plan to fix it, but I want to make you aware of what's happening. And I think they appreciated that. And the other thing was there was a huge snowstorm in Nashville the week we were closing, and a bunch of the underground pipes under the parking lot burst.
Uh-oh.
And the parking lot, you can imagine a city like Nashville is not prepared for big snowstorms. So all of a sudden our parking lot was in shambles, and there was all kinds of work that had to be done. So there was a lot of coordination with us, with the sellers, and with the brokers to get that resolved and get everything closed on time. And thankfully we were able to do that.
When that happens, who pays for it?
On that one, the seller paid for most of it. We ended up paying for some of it ourselves as well.
And then stretching the dollars?
Stretching the dollars, sure. In today's market, as I'm sure you know, and many of the best ever listeners know, it is an extremely, extremely competitive multifamily market. We're competing against pension funds, foreign money. There's more equity chasing apartment deals right now in 2015 than there's probably been in the last 20 years. So buying deals where, you know, you're looking for a certain cap rate and a certain interest rate on your loan and a certain spread between that, those spreads are going down and down and down. So what you need to do is to win deals in today's market, you're going to need to stretch your number. So what I mean by that is we typically hold properties for the long term. We look to put usually Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac debt on the deals, 10-year fixed loans, sometimes 12-year fixed loans now. To hold these properties for a while. And what you need to do is decide, okay, if I want to continue to buy properties in today's market because the long-term demographics look good, the financing looks good, to do that, I'm going to pay a little more than I would have had to a couple of years ago. And what you need to do is set a line in the sand and say, I like the property up to this point, and if you don't like it past that point, you have to stop. But that point has, I think, over the last couple of years gotten pushed a little further for people, and people are willing to, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, you wouldn't look at anything if you didn't have a 10% cash on cash return. And now you may be happy with an 8.5% to 9% cash on cash return.
Sean, are you ready for the best ever lightning round?
Let's do it, Joe.
All right. First, a quick word from our best ever partners.
Crowdfunding. You've heard about it, and now it's time to learn about it. Our best ever sponsor, Patch of Land, is a leading expert in the crowdfunding space, and they've got all the answers to your crowdfunding questions. Go to patchofland.com/best ever and grab your copy of the top 10 answers to the top 10 crowdfunding questions. That's P-A-T-C-H-O-F-L-A-N-D
lend.com/best ever.
Are you still chasing down rent checks every month? Cozy provides free online rent collection and screening tools to landlords just like you. Automate your business for free. Sign up at cozy.co. That's COZY.co. Sean, what's the best ever book you've read?
You know, I can't think of my best ever book and not mention Rich Dad, Poor Dad, because that book changed the course of my entire life. But I'd also like to mention one other book that I'm guessing not as many people have read. That's Emotional Intelligence by Daniel Goleman, Harvard PhD and New York Times writer. He was the first to really bring emotional intelligence, and it's important to the mainstream. I've always found that to be just a fascinating concept, and I think that's one of the things that's helped me navigate my career. And, you know, I have to mention Mastery by Robert Greene. I'm currently reading that book, and what an absolute genius that guy is.
That guy is an absolute genius. My favorite book, or one of them, is 48 Laws of Power by Robert Greene. I also have read The Art of Seduction by Robert Greene. Haven't read that, the one you just referred to, but I will. And for any best ever listener, we have a conversation with Robert Kiyosaki, the author of Rich Dad Poor Dad, on this show, episode 262. So go ahead and check that out. But not right now. Let's finish up this conversation. Best ever personal growth experience and what you learned from it.
Joe, I think that was taking the huge risk of leaving my successful sales job early in my career and becoming the receptionist at Thompson Dorfman Partners. Probably the biggest risk of my life up to that point. And as I said before, on paper, it didn't make sense. But my gut told me it was the right move. And, you know, I learned two really important lessons from that. One is just to surround yourself with great people. I could have done great work at that firm, but if my bosses weren't great people and true to their word as well, I never would have left that front desk. And secondly, you know, if I need to bet on something, I've really learned to bet on myself. Every time I'm facing a difficult decision, I talk to my wife. She always reminds me, hey, bet on yourself. And, you know, it's interesting. I read somewhere the other day that if you're not betting on yourself, you're actually actively betting against yourself.
Best ever success habit you practice.
Maybe you can tell because I listed three books when you asked me about the favorite book, but
indecisiveness.
Yeah, I read as much as possible. And I've actually started listening to podcasts just like yours when I'm in the car. I'm a big believer that, you know, we're only here for a short while and you don't have enough time to learn all the lessons you need to in life on your own. And I really think that's where books come in. I feel like you, in a few days, you can read someone's entire life story and pull all the lessons and experiences out of it that you need.
Best ever deal you've done.
We invest primarily in the Midwest and the Southeast. So as I said, we're typically looking for cash flow. We like to say we're trying to hit singles and doubles, but every once in a while, you know, you get lucky and hit a home run. But a year and a half ago, a nice looking deal came up for sale on auction.com. Property was in very good condition, didn't need much work. It was 204 units built in 2004, and it had been foreclosed upon by a lender the year before that. We didn't know anything about auction.com, but I made it my mission to kind of learn everything as quickly as I could. We weren't allowed to walk the units or do your typical due diligence prior to bidding. And then we found out if we were the winning bidder, we'd actually have to put down over $1 million of non-refundable earnest money the day after the auction. But it was a clean deal. We liked the location, so we took the risk and decided to bid. And we ended up being the winning bidder on the property and felt that despite the risks, we got a great price on the property. We had to close very, very quickly. So we used a floating bank loan to finance the purchase. And when we refinanced the property 9 months later into our typical 10-year fixed rate loan, it appraised for $2 million above our purchase price.
Best ever project you're most excited about right now?
You know, Joe, I'm really passionate about real estate and housing in particular, and I'm just honestly really excited about the long-term future of housing. I feel like we're living in a really exciting time. Our cities are changing. The country's projected to add millions and millions of people in the next 20 years. I'm just really excited to be part of city building and positive change. And, you know, on a personal note, my wife and I had our first kid a couple years ago, and I'm super excited every single day about being a husband and being a father.
Well, congratulations on being a father. That's awesome.
Thank you.
What's the best ever way you like to give back?
I volunteer a lot of my time and have held several leadership positions with the Urban Land Institute, which is a nonprofit land use organization that the mission is to create thriving and sustainable communities worldwide.
Best ever quote.
I was a baseball player, Joe, and a hockey player growing up prior to all the other crazy things I did. And my favorite quote has always been Wayne Gretzky. You miss 100% of the shots you don't take.
What's the biggest mistake you've made in real estate?
Biggest mistake is definitely the times that I've second-guessed myself and not acted on opportunities that I knew were opportunities. I should have bought as much real estate as I could between 2009 and 2011, maybe early 2012 as well. When I moved to Minneapolis in late 2009 and got to know the area, and then throughout 2010, it seemed an opportune time to buy real estate. I saw opportunities all over the place, had access to some of them, but I didn't execute on them. I was concerned that, you know, I was new to this market, maybe I was missing something. And in hindsight, it turned out I had fresh eyes, and that was a huge advantage. But the lesson for the future that I take away is to always be aware of where we are in the real estate cycle and not to be afraid to be aggressive and buy property in down markets, because that's really where the money's made. We're looking at a lot of deals and seeing a lot of deals today that people bought in 2009, 2010, and 2011, and they're turning around now 4 or 5 years later and selling them and making an absolute killing. Now is a great time to be a seller, but as I said, you have to have something to sell.
Best ever place to reach you.
Few different places you can reach me. I think LinkedIn. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn, so you can look me up, Sean Sweeney. You'll find me there in Minneapolis. You can also email me directly at ssweeney, and my last name is spelled S-W-E-E-N-E-Y, at timberlandpartners.com. That's all one word. Or as I've heard some other guests do, Joe, I'll tell people you can call me, especially if you have a good apartment deal or any acting gigs. 612-919-3461.
Enlightening, wonderful conversation, totally informative, and you are the epitome of what a best ever guest delivers to the listeners, and I'm so grateful for this conversation. I know the best ever listeners are. Some of the things I took away from it, one, just your approach to business, to life, where you throw yourself in a situation based on a gut feeling. Also, I like the book Blink by Malcolm Gladwell, where he talks about we thin slice things based on all of our cumulative experiences. And in addition to it being your gut experience, I think it was also the accumulation of your experience from law and from the sales job at the money management company, where you saw an opportunity here, because you wouldn't have just taken that receptionist gig at any company. It was this one in particular that you were betting on. And just throwing yourself in there, learning it. Then also, I love how you got into the specifics of how do you determine which deals to focus on? Because you get a ton of deals on a weekly basis. And you went through step by step. One, does it fit our buying criteria? Two, how about the location? What's it look like? Three, what's the story behind the property? Who owns it? What's the motivation? Is there a value add opportunity? Four, calling the broker, figuring out what are they thinking the price will shake out to be? What's the competition? How many people are going to put an offer on this place? How many do they anticipate? And then five, the back of the napkin, where you take the income, which is the effective gross income, or you take the income, then you take 50% of the expenses from the effective gross income, and then you've got an NOI, then you see what the cap rate is for that area, and then you got a valuation. Then you see if you're close to where they're wanting to sell it at. Thank you also for offering to share that one sheet for the numbers, that spreadsheet. Best ever listeners, I'll go ahead and put that in the show notes page. Just click the link right there at joefairless.com. And you can get that spreadsheet for yourself. Well, thank you so much again, Sean. Wonderful conversation. And lastly, is there anything else you want to mention to best ever listeners?
No, not really, Joe. I just want to thank you for the opportunity. It was great to talk to you, and I'm glad you found some value in what I had to say.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Joe.
Hey, you, best ever listener. Do you want more? Then go to joefairless.com, where you'll get tons of free videos, templates, and content to help you get deals done. And remember to subscribe to the best ever show in iTunes, so you can keep getting your daily dose of the best real estate investing advice ever.